The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So, good evening, everyone, and welcome to IMC. Is this loud enough for you, the volume of this? Yeah? Okay. So, I've been thinking some about how much we think. And how, you know, thinking is important, for sure, but some of us think too much. And maybe some of us think too little. But the fixation with thinking, the preoccupation with thinking that is such a big part of much human life is certainly a fascinating topic to get familiar with. It's a fascinating thing to bring your attention to and understand better how it works for you, all this. And to talk about it a little bit today, I would like to tell a little fable or little simile for this, if you will, willing to go along. And that is, there is this place, beautiful place in nature, spectacularly vast, beautiful, natural setting. In the middle of this natural, wonderful setting, there's a building. There's a very large building. We've never seen such a large building. And it's a one-room building. Now, what's very unusual about this very, very big one-room building is that all the walls, the four walls of the building, are not conventional walls, but rather are a series of doors and door frames, and the door frames butt up against each other, one after the other. It's all the way around, and all the doors are open. That's nice. But there's people who live inside, and it turns out that they only think about door frames. They're fixated on the door frames. Door frames is what they live for. And so they spend their time focusing on the door frames, and some of them have their own personal ones. Some people share door frames. They like to decorate them, put up, you know, beautiful lipstick and all kinds of wonderful paintings and tattoos on the door frames. And they like to, or they put spikes on them so keep people away. Some people like to protect their door frames by putting door frames in front of them. And sometimes there's a series of door frames. And when they talk about things, they talk about the door frames with each other. And they just, you know, that's all they ever focus on and think about is door frames. And after a while, they decide to have a religion about door frames, and right in the middle of this big room, they build a special door frame, and they circumambulate at the door frame and worship it and bow to it, and it's held up in high esteem. And because the door frames are so important, some people make miniature door frames, and they put it around their heads or in their neck and walk around with them. And some of them are considered very precious. So then they've also made door frames into weapons. And they go around banging each other on the head with door frames. So then they also, then because to protect themselves, they get more door frames, and they build forts, all around them, just door frames, and protect themselves. And they're just amazed by how much you can do with door frames. It's like they're in awe, and then a genius will come along and be born into their society, and they'll figure out a new thing to do with door frames. It's really a wonderful, wonderful time. All kinds of door frames. And there used to be all these forests inside the building, but those have long since been cut down for the sake of door frames. And then one day, someone decided to meditate, sat down. No one had meditated there for centuries. sat down and got very calm and peaceful. And in getting up out of the meditation, for a little while, wasn't fixated on anything. Wasn't preoccupied, wasn't particularly thinking about door frames. And so kind of just walked around, looked around, and noticed that between the door frames were these open spaces. No one had ever seen that before, because it's all about the door frames. And it turns out there's more open space in the wall, because the doors are all open, than there are door frames. So the person, you know, without thinking about it too much, just walked out and found that there was a whole world outside the building. Came back in and said, "Hey everyone, there's more to life than door frames." No one, people thought he was crazy, that she was crazy. How can that be? I mean, door frames, it's all there is, that's where you live for, and that's what it's all about. And I don't know if it's safe not to think about door frames. You know, how can you be responsible? How can you protect yourself? How can you build up a good life without thinking about door frames? And they thought about locking that person up because it seemed so strange. That, you know, there was the strange concept of open space, like space between the door frames. No one had ever thought about it or even noticed. It took a few centuries more. And then someone else kind of meditated and got up their meditation. It wasn't particularly thinking about anything, so certainly not door frames. Look at that. There's space. Wow, that's fascinating. And that person stepped over. So we live often preoccupied with thoughts. And it's very hard to imagine for some people there's anything else. Thinking is kind of so ubiquitous, so kind of the place where we're working things out, where we're figuring out our lives, where we're figuring out who we are, where we're planning whatever we're going to plan, where we're remembering whatever we need to remember, where we're kind of trying to solve all our problems. And it's so kind of almost so natural or so frequent or so common that sometimes people don't even realize how much they're doing. And any idea that maybe you don't have to always be thinking sometimes is met with surprise or disinterest or even sometimes with a sense of horror that how could I do that? How could I take care of my responsibilities in life unless I think and plan and build and worry? Or how am I going to get what I want? Because I have to kind of figure out how to acquire. Or how am I going to fix the past if I don't review it and review it and review it? And so thinking, one way or the other, for some people is almost like the water the fish swims through. It's like the medium in which their whole life is negotiated and understood. And when we encounter other people, we get to know them. But to a big extent, sometimes we get to know them through the way we think about them, our thoughts, our ideas, our projections, and all that. When we get to know ourselves, it's often through the medium of our thoughts, if it's really kind of obsessive and just thinking a lot. If it's the world around us, we look at the world through the filter of what I want, what I can get from it, what I can do for me. And in some ways in the modern world, it's possible we've improved on this tendency because now it's not just thoughts, but it's also devices. And sometimes the addiction to devices is almost, strong as thinking or as comparable where you got to check all the time and be, that's where the world is and this two-dimensional world, that's it. And so it's possible to discover that there are doors to walk through, there's space, there's something else besides all the thinking. And what is that? Well, certainly there are simple things, like there is possible to feel instead of to think all the time. It's possible to see instead of to think, and to have one's eyes clear, to really see what's there. First time this happened for me, I was about 20, and it didn't happen through meditation, but it happened through being alone for a week. I was living on a small farm, and I was left there to take care of the cows, and just me and the cows. And in the course of those 7 days, my vision got clearer and clearer. And everything I looked at by the fifth or sixth day, everything I was looking at was sparkling. And I was like, wow, this is pretty cool. And it was the time spent alone was kind of like being on retreat. My preoccupation with thoughts, social concerns with the people I usually lived with, the stimulation I got from the social life that we lived with, all these things settled down and my mind became calm and peaceful. And in that calm and peace, my senses started working much more acutely. Some people report that they hear much better when they stop being so caught up in their thoughts. But also, there's a kind of space that's possible to walk into or to see. And I love it when my mind is quiet enough or calm enough, slow down enough, that there's actually space between my thoughts. And so I'm not always thinking. And the space might be brief, a moment or so, but that moment shows me that there's something more, and something more interesting for me sometimes than what I'm thinking about. And because in that space, sometimes I can feel a sense of vastness, a sense of peacefulness, a sense of freedom, that I'm not it's a place where I'm not caught by anything or involved with things or incessantly trying to accomplish something through my thoughts or fix something through my thoughts or plan something or just fantasize, whatever it might be. And there's a question that I'm really fond of asking myself sometimes, and I like to ask it sometimes here, that if your thoughts are not rushing, so you kind of go from one thought to the next without any gap, if you slow down enough and so there's, you have a thought, hopefully it's a good one, and then there's a pause, and then you think another one, even if it's just a paragraph break, that's enough. Then in between the end of one thought and the beginning of the next, when you have no thoughts in that gap, who are you? What that means is, who are you when you don't use thoughts to tell you? And I find that kind of mind-stopping. It's already stopped, but I feel more expansive when I ask that question, because then there's no definition. I'm not saying, as soon as I can't answer it with a word or an idea or even my name, there's something that kind of opens up, space opens up, or it's like taking off a coat that's been heavy or a backpack that's heavy, and suddenly I feel kind of lighter. And then from that space that sometimes then I can have a sense that not only even when I'm thinking, there's a bigger space in the mind. When I'm thinking a lot, it can feel claustrophobic. But when I'm calm enough and centered enough and not fixated in my thoughts, I have a sense sometimes of the space around thoughts. Thoughts don't have any shape, I don't think. They have no weight. But sometimes the way people relate to the thoughts, they're like the most substantial, serious thing in the universe. Whereas, in fact, they're pretty insubstantial. I don't think they have any weight or shape or, these things. But sometimes I have a sense that, I don't have a sense of thinking have a shape exactly, but I do sometimes have a sense that they kind of have a diffuse kind of boundary, how big they are. And there's this vast space beyond the thoughts. The universe is not made up totally by your thought. Our thoughts are not that powerful or that big, or they're kind of local. And you'd want my thoughts to stay local, some of them. And So, but I get a sense of this vastness or this openness beyond it, peacefulness, quiet beyond it. And I find it very nurturing to tune in to this quiet that's beyond thoughts, or this other dimension that's going on, this calm place that's beyond thoughts. And some people will, so for me, I like the idea of kind of the larger place. Some people will talk about the stillness and quiet that's below thoughts or inside, where they're not thinking. It just feels like a safe and still and quiet place. And what's kind of beginning to what it does is begins to change our relationship to thinking. And I think that's one of the really wise things to do in this practice. You don't necessarily want to kind of live and abide in some vast silent space. That'll get old soon, I guess, if that's all there is. But to have that openness or that peacefulness or calm be a reference point or support to help us take a better look at what goes on when we're thinking, so that we can see the pull of attachment, the glue that keeps us kind of stuck onto our thoughts. You know, there's one thing, there's you, whatever that is, and there's your thoughts, whatever they are, and then there's the connection between them. So, for example, there can be interest in the thinking. There can be leaning towards the thought. There can be more than interest. There can be desperation. There can be horror. There can be granting, we don't do this consciously, but there's this granting of our thoughts a lot of authority, because we can invest a lot of importance in what we're thinking. And so, you know, we just, there's this glue, I think of it as glue, that keeps us there. And you can feel that glue, you can feel the connection, or the bungee cord, or the rubber band, or I don't know what it is, the pull towards it. So rather than focusing on what you're thinking about, and, you know, focus on that connection that you have to it, the fascination, the interest, the fear that might be involved or fueling the thinking. And that's an interesting place to hang out and be mindful of. If we don't see what's fueling it or the interest we have in it, that interest will keep pulling us into the thinking. It'll still operate, but it operates unconsciously. But if we see it, then it doesn't have the same power over us. It doesn't operate as freely. And you might find there's more space in the mind. You might find you have more choice about how you relate to your thoughts. It might also help you to kind of start seeing the thoughts much more clearly for what they are. And there's many answers to the question, you know, what are they? There's many dimensions to thoughts or many perspectives in which to look at them. But I think one of the things to consider is once we start getting tuning into how much we think, is how much do we see the world through the thoughts? How much are the thoughts projections onto the world? And everyone does this. Everyone has thoughts and conceptions in their mind that they project on the world. We kind of need to be efficient and get around here. But we seldom recognize how much we do. But if we can start recognizing that we do it, then we can start taking more responsibility when we do it too much and do it in ways which are actually harmful for each other. So, for example, we call this a meditation center. You know, if you live in Redwood City, you know, maybe someone says, oh, I'm going down to the local meditation center, and people in Redwood City know what's IMC maybe. So it's the meditation center. The idea that this is a meditation center, if that's the way you're talking, is a projection, is a thought that you have that you're projecting on this building. There's nothing inherent about this building being a meditation center. This used to be a church. When they wanted to sell the church, around the time they sold it to us, they were thinking of selling it to people to have it as a nursery school. So imagine what this would be today if this was a nursery school. And this room would be quite something. And probably a different color. And people would say the nursery school down the street. But just same building, right? So partly we call things by their function. So this is a meditation center, we call it by that function. But that's a projection, that's an idea, a concept. And some things shift and change what they are. And so it's a meditation hall, meditation room now. What it was in a little over an hour and a half ago, this was a yoga room. Or we say they were doing yoga in the meditation room, but are we doing meditation in the yoga room? These things are all kind of arbitrary, how exactly we call it, but it's a thought that we overlay on top of it. And this here issue here about the room and the building is pretty mild, but what about when we do this to other people? What about when you do it to your friends or strangers or your enemies? What do you project onto them? Do you see them for who they are, or do you see them through the filter of your thoughts and ideas that you have? That when you see them, you're thinking about what the conversation you had last time. When you see them, you're thinking about that person as belonging to a group, a category of people. And so you don't just see, you know, an individual, you see a person who belongs to a race. And so... You know, race is relatively arbitrary. It's a human construct, the idea of race. But once we put people into a category of, you know, seeing that way, then there's all kinds of other things that follow, sometimes quite painful for the whole society. And so to watch and see how thoughts operate and see how a thought and idea arises and how we see through that thought, that's a dangerous person. That's a desirable person. That's a person who's going to help me go further in life at work, and I better. That's a person who is not going to do anything for me, you know. And so we kind of ignore them or something. Don't pay attention. All these kind of, you know, sometimes very quite terrible ways we think. And sometimes it comes through some idea that's arisen in their head. Sometimes fairly subconscious. So we don't even see all the door frames that we're relating to all the time. So part of the function of meditation is to quiet down enough so that we can start noticing what goes on in our minds. And one of the things to notice is the role of thinking, how thinking works. And whether you think in words or you think in images, some people can be just as fixated on it, so concerned with it, going on incessantly. Thinking. And it's possible to ask oneself as we slow down and look at it more carefully, why do we think? Not just what we think, but why are we thinking? Some people are doing it for entertainment. Some people are trying to avoid being bored. Some people are doing it in order to solve their problems, to make themselves safe. Some people are doing it for, you know, I don't know, all kinds of things. It's important to think, for sure. What I'd like to propose is that you think a lot better if you're not addicted to thinking. You think a lot better if you know how to be calm and you're not glued to your thoughts. There isn't this kind of drive or this strong instinct to think. But if you slow down, learn how to have a calm mind at times. Learn not to be so dependent on thinking as the vehicle to which to understand your life and yourself. The thoughts can operate in a simpler way. Simple thoughts or relaxed thinking. Not driven thoughts, not desperate thoughts, not fast thoughts. Slow thoughts, lots of space. My impression is thoughts work much more effectively and efficiently. I'm surprised sometimes how much intelligence my thoughts have when I'm not trying to think. It seems like they work better, and I somehow understand things more intuitively, and all kinds of things can operate. So one of the things we do in mindfulness practice is we become mindful of thinking. And mindfulness of thinking does not mean we think about our thoughts. It means closer to we're silent in relationship to our thoughts. We bring a kind of silent observation, silent presence, silence, attention to the fact that we're thinking. And maybe as we do this, we can also focus on our breathing in meditation. Breathing is a way of shifting our attention from thoughts into something else. And the rhythm of breathing is often a very good place to go. And then we stop sending so much energy into the world of thinking. This energy of attention is one of the most precious resources we have. And where it gets directed, it's like food that feeds something. So if you're constantly directing to your thoughts, if you're constantly directing it to fearful thoughts, or greedy thoughts, or hateful thoughts, you're kind of reinforcing it. But if you can take this wonderful tool, the wonderful resource of attention, and to direct it away from thoughts to something as simple as being grounded in your body as you breathe, then we're not going to be feeding those thoughts so much, and the thoughts tend to calm down. It's considered one of the great psychological techniques to calm down anxious thoughts is to breathe consciously. So in meditation, we do quite a bit of that. And hopefully the mind calms down enough that we're not caught up in the web of thinking anymore. And then we see that once we're not caught up in the web, we see that actually the web is made up of more empty space than it is of all the, you know, cross twines. It's like the door frames, right? There's much more space in the open door than there is door frames. And then there's a different world we live in. And perhaps the door frames of our lives or the webs of our life, the gaps are much bigger than we thought. And we're not actually trapped. They're so big we can walk right through. But you know, you have to kind of take your eyes off the door frame a little bit. Door frames won't mind. So I hope that that analogy, you could go along with it and make it interesting for you, relevant somehow. Do you have any comments or questions about this that you'd like to ask, or protests? Finally, some people with thoughts.
Hi.
One thing I notice I think about a lot is planning for the future. And then sometimes I catch myself at it and I realize that what I'm doing is expressing mistrust in future me. Mm. And it can be very freeing to just trust that guy and just trust him and just let go in that trust.
How does he do usually when he shows up?
Future me?
Yeah,
just fine.
In the present. His track record in the present is relatively good?
Oh, it's great, yeah.
Hey, wow. So why don't you stick with what you know how to do?
Right.
Since you don't seem to know how to think about the future. I was a slow learner give up thinking, planning a lot. Because I did a lot of it, partly because I was nervous about what was coming and the meeting I was coming to or something. But after a while, because I was kind of noticing what I was doing, I discovered that I had a very poor track record of success. That, I would plan something ahead, it was going to be this way, I'd show up and it was different. The whole event was canceled or different people were there or something else was going on or all kinds of things. And my idea to predict what the future was like was very poor. And so after a while, I kind of got the got got the message, you know. I'm wasting a lot of time for a future that never comes.
Yeah, that's what I meant. Present me
doesn't
plan the future as well as future me just takes care of it. So it's the future me who's doing great.
Leave him alone.
Yeah.
Great.
I have really put a lot of thought about thinking. And I finally come to realize that my biggest problem is my own mind and intellect.
Your own mind?
My own mind and intellect.
Oh, yes.
If you could maybe talk to us a little bit more about our own mind and how we can just separate from it and maybe let these thoughts exist, but just walk away from them.
Yeah, it's possible just to watch thoughts go by and not kind of pick them up or be involved with them. There's this wonderful expression sometimes of have thoughts be like clouds drifting in an endless sky. So just they come through. And in meditation, when people, it especially happens on meditation retreats, but it can happen in daily meditation as well, where the thoughts get quieter and stiller, and they feel more wispy, they feel thinner. They feel, some people talk about they get thinner and thinner or lighter and lighter, and because we're not involved anymore and they just float right through and, you know, we're not caught in them. But you ask the question of what should you do about this mind? Should you just kind of pull away or, I don't know. I think the best thing to do with the mind rather than with thinking is probably just to love it. If you're kind and gracious and compassionate for your mind, probably the mind will behave better.
I find it, it's going mad at me. I mean, it's really going mad. It's just like this thing wants to keep on going and going. It's like I can't, you know.
But it doesn't do that. But it probably has some deep need. What emotion is driving all that thinking?
Typically, it's either just like what this gentleman said, it's usually fear, or you're either looking at the future or the past, mm-hmm. and neither of them exist at that moment. So
maybe your fear needs you. Needs you to pay attention to it and listen to it and kind of be present. And one of the great tasks around the fear that we feel is to help your fear feel safe. What do you think would happen to your fear when it finally felt safe? If you're trying to get rid of it, it's poor fear. Fear doesn't feel good then. So you might, you know, this idea of loving it or have compassion and recognize the fear and kind of hold it there. Like maybe even imagine that you have your soft hands underneath the fears in front of you and just like, here, it's okay now. You can be afraid. I'm allowing you to be here and I'll care for you. What do you think of that?
Wonderful. Thank you.
I had a question about the guy in the beginning of your story, where, like, I was thinking, so say there's a person who's in this community, and they go outside the community, and then they come back, and everybody says, you're crazy, uh-huh. you know, we're gonna lock you up, you know, you're a liar, and everybody gets all upset at him, and that's the only community that he knows, right?
Yeah.
Like, he's very attached to these people.
Yeah.
So if you're in that situation where, like, or if the guy was in that situation, like, how would, you know, he go about, like, dealing with that situation?
Being upset
that everybody's calling him a liar and he's dividing the community. Some people leave him, some people don't. He's trying not to get locked up.
Well, if it's that bad, probably the person shouldn't talk about the door. If people can't hear it and it's dangerous to talk about it, and it's dividing the community in ways, maybe there's no need to talk about it. There's no need to convert people to the door way. But just.
But then how does he defend himself? How does he exist within that community?
Person's part of the community first, right? Then discovers the door, goes outside, and then comes back. And people get upset when the person says, there's this other world, the other aspect. And they get upset, right? So just don't tell them.
Yeah, but then they're sitting. Then he doesn't say anything, and they're still trying to tell him he's crazy.
But that person can still be peaceful then. But they don't have to, doesn't have to tell people. I mean, it can be private, can't it? And they, and after a while, people say, wow, that person's...
But not if they're trying to lock him up.
But they're only locking up because the guy's...
Or not if they're, like, screaming at him constantly.
Yeah, but I think what we're talking about, they're only locking him up because the person has told them about this other way of being.
And what if he already came back? And what if he already said it? You kind of, like, once you open up the door, you can't kind of go back.
Okay.
And how does he have meta for those people in that situation when you're being, like, screamed at and told?
Yeah. This is important. I appreciate the question. I mean, this is all too common that in some way or other that there are families and communities where there's all kinds of dysfunction going on. And someone is trying to grow up, or someone's trying to become free, or be more mature, or be not caught in the web that's so thick. Then people who are left feel you know, angry and upset, or feel offended, or feel threatened by this, or something. And so some people have to just, some people will just make a decision because they want to stay connected to that community to be quiet and kind of hide something and not share it with because it's too dangerous. So, on the other end of the extreme, there are people who says, well, this is insincere. I lose my integrity. I lose something that's very powerful. I'm very sad, but I can't stay in this community anymore. And some people will find tools, interpersonal tools, to learn how to have these difficult conversations or how to maneuver and move so as not to offend people or how to to talk about things in a way that, I don't know how to say it, but...
It makes things worse.
What? No, it doesn't make things worse, right. And maybe even makes things better by learning communication skills learning how to have difficult conversations, learning how to do social Aikido, learning timing, you know, to learning the right time to speak up and say something. And so if it's really in a community like a family where these dynamics are really strong, it might be important to spend some time with a therapist and really understand for oneself what those social dynamics are. The family dynamics, the community dynamics, because it might be hard, it's unless we understand it well, it's also very hard for us to negotiate and find our way with it.
Yeah.
And so take time to learn how these things work and then also to try to understand better what is it that's driving the people who are angry. A lot of people who are angry and hateful are in a lot of pain and they don't want to stop being angry. Because then they have to look at their sadness or their sorrow or their own pain that they are carrying. And so, but it's possible sometimes to start noticing that and seeing that, kind of listen to them between the lines and what's going on. And maybe that you don't want to point it out to them, that would be maybe terrible. But maybe when you speak to them, you speak to that part of them. Mm-hmm. Maybe when you go see them, you make sure you bring them a gift, you bring them chocolate cookies or something. You know, something that speaks to something beyond what they're reacting to. And as it's try to meet some other part of them or bring some other part of them. Who they're, there's all kinds of things to be done, but it's not easy at times. It's rare that I've heard it that extreme in terms of what we discover through meditation. Though sometimes families and friends get worried when people meditate because they are afraid they're going to lose their friend because they're growing. Maybe they're growing too much in ways that the other people are not. Is one thing
like that distancing, or trying to have a more mindful attachment is threatening.
Yeah, it's threatening to people, and so like if it's people we're close to, then you're doing this practice here, and people feel threatened by how you're growing or that you're meditating a lot and they feel like they're afraid you're going to go off and be a monastic or do something. I think it's really important to bring a lot of love and care to our relationships. So you want to reassure them or express your love or your commitment to the relationship. I had, when I was first started to be a Zen student, I was first starting to do meditation quite a bit. I had a girlfriend, and it was I think it was a nice relationship. But she had this thing. She wanted a lot of. I think she called them strokes. But she wanted to be reassured, told she was good, bolstered a lot. And being a new Zen student, kind of was all in the. I was kind of like a little bit maybe over idealistic. I was just discovering how much people were playing social games and wanting to build up their ego and their sense of self. And so I wasn't going to have any part of that. So I just ignored it. So that relationship ended. And years later, what I realized was that I had wisdom about the relationship, what was going on, and it wasn't. It was maybe appropriate not to participate in the social games that she wanted, but what I didn't replace it with was compassion for her, was care for her, understanding of what was going on, and I could have met it with. I could have met her need with something else besides what she wanted. And so to recognize what is a deeper need that people have they don't even know, and try to meet that, and maybe you can disarm them. So if you get around to thinking this week, you might stop and take a deeper look at what's going on for you, and see if you can get a bird's eye view of the, you know, step back and what is this thing thinking, as opposed to being kind of in the trenches with your thoughts. And I hope that in the process of doing. Being mindful of thoughts, learning how they all work, learning how to be free of them, learning to find the space between them, around them, that